So we've got all the way from Oxford University, the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography, Danny Dorling. He's come to talk to us about his latest book, which is Shattered Nation and its inequality and the geography of a failing state, this book here. It's at once timely and poignant. Through use of meticulous research and hard-hitting facts, he's taking us across the four countries that make up the UK, examining issues from hunger, employment, and fear, charting how these things have changed from the time of William Beveridge following the Second World War, bringing us all up from the COVID pandemic to the present day. Incisive and brutally honest, Shattered Nation calls for a rethink on how we do things through greater honesty and empathy. So, here to tell us a bit more, can we all welcome Danny Dorling?
Thank you ever so much for coming. I'm amazed you're here. Not least because it's very cold and very wet outside, but also given the title of the book, who wants to come and hear about a shattered nation? What I've learned to do, the book was published in September, is to start off with some good news, because otherwise, honestly, it is. I'm warning you, it gets worse. And I'm going to just talk for half an hour, by the way, so we've got lots and lots of time to have a discussion. You did ask, you wanted an Oxford-style lecture, which would be a whiteboard and graphs. No graphs, we're going to do it without that. Good news, if we were in Oxford, the story I would start off was the story of the summer of 2023 and what happened in the city of Oxford in 23. And I would spend 10 minutes showing you pictures of an obscure place called Parson's Pleasure. Does anybody here know? Well, I've got one, okay. So this wouldn't work for you. Parson's Pleasure was, when I was a boy, was where the lecturers, male, were allowed to bathe nude. It's where I first got to see a lot of male genitalia, which was very good for my mental health as a pubescent teenager, because anyway, I won't go into that. But because of this bathing place, which had existed right up until 1991, we couldn't have a cycle path across the meadows to Oxford into the city, avoiding a very dangerous roundabout. People started to argue for a safe way into Oxford in the 1970s. The university opposed it. We finally got a path open in 1991. There were going to be two bridges. The two bridges were going to be staggered because you couldn't have young ladies going up a bridge too high and looking and seeing the naked men. And then at the last minute, they decided the two bridges could be straight and the male nude flashing ended. In my city. So there's a kind of success. But the bad news is that the city expands, you get more and more people, and the roundabout, which had always been known to be dangerous, becomes more dangerous. The second most dangerous roundabout in the south of England. Three members of university staff in the last 2 years have died on bikes on that roundabout. The bad news is that the university decides one of the bridges needed to be repaired, and it's going to repair it starting on August the 10th, no warning, and it'll be closed for 10 weeks. Now, why does this matter? It matters because 10 weeks from August the 10th, I know you have different summer holidays here, it's our summer holiday still ongoing, but for the children going to secondary school for the first time on the 3rd of September, they're going to have to go round the second most dangerous roundabout in the south of Europe. There was a campaign. 2 days before the schools opened, the university relented and allowed school children, my university relented and allowed school children to go through the parks if they pushed their bike and somebody monitored them. But it was a success, it was a victory. And I always start off with a victory somewhere, but it has to mean something to the people. I can do better for you. So the one I'll give you, let's see, this isn't going to work, but I'll try it. I did this at Leeds. I've done it at Nottingham. There was a country. And this country was dealing with a pandemic, as all countries were. But the cost of living crisis began during the pandemic. It began to become evident that prices were starting to rise. We put it down to the inability of companies to move goods around the world. Food was getting a bit more expensive. Heat was getting a bit more expensive. The government of this country enacted its emergency committee, looked at what it could do, put some regulations in to stop landlords evicting people, but also introduced a very small payment. The payment was £10 a week for any children under the age of six if your parents received any kinds of benefits. The payment was increased and then increased again in November 2022 to £25 a week for any child under 16 in a family receiving any benefits. This was two out of all seven children. For a family of three, by now, this is over £4,000 in a year. It's untapered. You get the money regardless. And the effect of that, of course, is huge on the families of the children getting this. So I'm going to test out with you. This will be interesting. The average audience takes 10 guesses to work out which country. And the clue is it's in Europe. So who knows which country this is in Europe? Go on. Scotland, yes, yes. Okay, you should have got it first. Scotland. Now, that is the first time this has happened to me. I was hoping it would happen. It would be highly upsetting if you didn't know. It's normally Norway or Finland. Then it's Finland and Norway, the other way around. Then it's Sweden. Then it's the Netherlands. Then it's Germany. Then it's France. Then it's Switzerland. 10. Always 10. Before eventually, and it's not really a trick question. I say country in Europe. Right. In England, they have no idea. Absolutely no idea. Not reported at all. The big study that was supposed to begin on this, funded, I think, by Nuffield Foundation. They haven't got the money. So we're not even going to get the comparator study because it makes sense. If you're a slightly disinterested social scientist, you go, hey, we've got an actual experiment. Let's set up a cohort down south and of course in Scotland and see how they compare. But there are good news stories. That particular one, the Scottish Child Payment, is possibly, when I work it out on the back of an envelope, the biggest reduction in child poverty in a year anywhere in Europe since 1989. I haven't done it properly. I've just worked it out. I'm assuming 90% uptake. But we'll know soon. Because there are very, very diligent, slightly staid civil servants here on this side of Scotland who do things very properly, and they will produce the results which will actually tell us. But it's not hard to do the maths and to actually work out, you know, £4,000 in a year. And of course, you already get child benefit on the third child because you're in Scotland. £4,000 extra without losing any of it means not going hungry and not going cold. And it's a choice, it has to be paid for. More importantly, you're choosing not to pay for other things, other age groups, other people, other services. There'll be all kinds of arguments, which thankfully I'm back down on the train and I can leave you to it, right? All I can do is say, this is possible, this has happened, you could do things. Why does it matter? So here we get into the start of the shattering. Resolution Foundation released their State of 2023 report at the start of this year. And even at the start of this year, we knew that 56% of children in the UK with two siblings were going hungry two or three times a month. Properly hungry, not peckish. We now have figures on hunger that we haven't seen since the 1930s rising. It is just shocking. It's quite, in some ways, quite sudden. But in other ways, and this is what I argue in the book, we've been building up to this since at least the 1990s. The average heights of our children are now falling. Right, they're falling. This is data published in The Lancet. That takes quite some doing. That's actually quite hard to achieve. The fall begins, at least from birth, in 2005. Now that matters politically. I'm going to upset any of you, no matter which political party you like, by the way, at the end of this, because this was in after 7 years of New Labour. Okay, the supposed million children out of poverty. It was a Chinese style million out of poverty. The Chinese style social stats are you find a group who are just above a line, i.e. they're just in poverty, and you find a way to give them money so they're just below the line. As far as they're concerned, nothing has changed. But you can say we've got our first million of the 4 million children. Why am I so confident about this? Because the Gini coefficient of income inequality didn't alter by 1%, not significantly, in any single year from 1997 to 2010. No improvement. In fact, it got worse for a few years, but no fall in income inequality, no actual fall in poverty in the New Labour years. You could say, let me draw your graph with my hands. Okay, inequality and poverty are very similar. If we go right back to the 60s, we have a relatively low rate of inequality down here, just above Sweden, better than France and Germany. We are more equal. We are essentially a Nordic country. And it's kind of hovering around there in the 60s. And then in the early 70s, our rate of inequality actually goes down slightly to the best year ever, which was 1974. Right? We are dominated by these conservative historians led by Dominic Sandbrook, who were not even alive in the 70s. I was there. And I have no appreciation of realising things were really, really good. 1974, we were competing with Finland. We're competing with Norway. 1974, we've just democratised the schools. We've got rid of an apartheid in our education system. The 11 plus is largely gone. We've built the social housing. It's there. The majority of parents at some point in their childhood lived in a council house. The majority. So I don't want to annoy anybody who's lived off, I grew up in the council house, but it just means you were normal. We had the highest life expectancy in the world, bar six very small countries, the lowest infant mortality rate. We had the first baby incubators at around the time I'm born. Inequality goes up slightly in the late 70s, so strikes. But pay goes up by more than inflation, partly because of those strikes. Then we get the 80s. So I won't repeat the 80s because you know the 80s. If you're young, you're going to have to, young in this corner, you're going to have to learn, sorry, you're going to have to learn the 80s. Dramatic year after year after year of things getting worse. Benjamin Zephaniah, his death was announced today. His writing is about, a lot of it is about the 80s and what happened then and how awful it was. And in the 80s, you kind of thought that this is a blip, you know. It's terrible, unbelievable, but we're not going to let that happen. And then we discovered that you can actually have three, nearer to four, if you count it properly, million people unemployed. Ideally, if they're young, and like in the 30s when they were middle-aged men, but if they're young people unemployed, you can get away with it. Because most people don't know somebody's unemployed, but it's 3 or 4 million, and they will vote Tory in 83 and in 87. And even in 1992. And by then, our inequality level is just below Portugal. We've beaten the rest of Western Europe. The top 30% who voted Conservatives did really well out of it. Their living standards rose on average. Right? Loads of money era. You carry right on to 1997. You get a new government. Finally, in 1997, after 18 years of Conservative rule, they promised, and they kept their promise, to keep Conservative spending pledges for 2 years, and you can see nothing happens in this graph. But then they didn't actually do anything to alter the inequality. They helped some groups, but not other groups. So on average, if you were in the bottom 10th of society, you were no better off. They put some double glazing into council housing, but they were embarrassed about it, so they didn't tell anybody about it, and they paid for war. So our public spending goes up. 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, this thing carries on. But other countries are getting better in Europe. So by about 2016, only Bulgaria is more unequal than us. Now, you might think, oh, well, at least we held inequality up here. It didn't go like that, even though we now have the highest in Europe. We're not as bad as South Africa or Brazil. But high inequalities like high blood pressure, right? Things get worse and worse as you hold it there. It's kind of stayed at that level since 2010. Except in 2008, we have a banking crisis. We become poorer as a country. Our salaries and wages begin to fall in real terms. And they still haven't recovered to 2008. So grossly unequal and poorer. Absolute deprivation rising. Immiseration increasing. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable by the comparisons. We get tetans and then hundreds of thousands of people dying prematurely. 2015, 16, 17, 18. This is all blamed on the flu originally. The first deaths that we saw were 212 women over 65 lost 2 weeks of life. Their life expectancy fell by just 2 weeks. Sounds trivial, but that hasn't happened for a century. And that was just the start. Why women over 65 first? George Osborne and the big cuts. George Osborne's cuts, he had a competition. If you could cut more than the next minister, you could be part of his gang in his star chamber. You might not remember the competition of who can cut the most. George Osborne's cuts decimated time and time and time again. Decimation is a 10% loss. Local authorities, many have lost over half of their income and their staff. Meals on Wheels services just went. Rural bus services went. Imagine you're a woman over 65, say 75, 80, and these things begin to go away. That's your welfare state. The difference between women over 65 and men over 65 is that on average, for that age group, a man over 65 will have a woman over 65 with him who on average will be 5 or 4 years younger than him. That's his welfare state, right? The women on average won't because the man's died before. Being on your own is worse. But that was just the start of it. The government reaction, I got a letter telling me to desist when we published this in the New Statesman. When I said Public Health England, as it was, we're getting it wrong. The government reaction was to claim it was flu, influenza, special British flu, one that wasn't occurring in the rest of Europe. I know. And we accepted it. Despite closing all those hospitals for all routine operations in January and February and the March of 2015 and 2018. We actually did get some flu in 2019, by the way. But flu doesn't actually kill that many people, so our life expectancy in 2019 finally returned to what it was in 2014 for a brief moment before a pandemic hit. And then we reported a higher mortality rate per million than other European countries, despite having killed off so many of our old and frail before the pandemic hit. We should have had a better record. Right? I've spent my whole life working with mortality data, so some of this comes over as unfeeling. But it was absolutely remarkable that we weren't in the top third of European countries for the pandemic, given that we didn't have that many old people left. Our life expectancy hadn't been rising. It's many years lower than the life expectancy in other European countries. The key thing about the pandemic was age. My father, who's still around, was 100 times more likely to die if he caught COVID than me. I was 100 times more likely than my then 20-year-old son. 10,000-fold difference in odds. We lost 15% of all our men over 90 and 10% of all our women in the pandemic. It was handled badly. More badly south of the border. It's really interesting. We got all the coverage, by the way, from Scotland during the pandemic because News 24 didn't know what to do. And Nicola kept on going on and for hours. And for some reason, the BBC put Nicola up for like an hour and a half a day in England. And she obviously cared. I mean, maybe too much, but took it to heart. Whereas you knew what was going on in Whitehall. You just, you know, if you were English and slightly clued in, you know, you could tell. You could tell what the attitude was. That's health, and I've got about 7 minutes left, so let's rattle through the rest of them. But our health is now awful. There are five countries in Eastern Europe which have a higher neonatal mortality rate than us. Just five. And often when I say this, people say, why shouldn't they be better? Which is fine, but it will be soon. Infant mortality is rising in the last year. It was rising in 2015, 2016. It's unheard of for this to occur. Depression, all the other things are off the scale. Education. And of course, these things vary by country. To annoy you who want to debate in Scotland, I'm afraid you do come out at the top of the four countries. But not simply because of one political party. Actually, ironically, and this is from a long, long away, from coalitions and alliances, which you may not notice here. One, there was a decision made this summer, as far as I can see, between Labour and the SNP. They wobbled about, let's fight over the Scottish child payment, and then they seem to have both just gone for it. Right? But you don't get things being progressive without actually some agreements on some things. It may not feel like it. It always feels like you're in the middle of an argument that people absolutely hate each other viciously. But some things are. Education, particularly south of the border, we've privatised the schools. We call it academising, but they're no longer under control. This was partly fortuitous because dozens of our local councils have now gone bust, of which the largest is Birmingham. When they go bust, like Slough, and there was another 24 to go bust, they have to sell all the assets off, including the schools. So at least they can't sell the schools off because they privatised them. So at least Slough keeps its state schools. This is where we are. And there are other kind of small mercies. At least one government minister this summer decided that when she was told that the concrete could fall at any point, she wasn't going to have it. The others, if you look back, the others were going, oh, we can risk it. We can have an Aberfan. But we have all these schools. And of course, we've privatised our universities in effect almost fully in 2012. Again, more south of the border, but you are charging the English and the overseas. So they're out of control. They're one of our three surviving profit-making industries. That's where the profit's increasing. And overseas students are export earners. Yeah. Average graduate, when I worked at Sheffield, you'd be making however many thousands on the fees, but then another $5,000 on the graduation for what the hotel's got. There's a university actually up here, which I won't name, which has talked about holding a double graduation. So, you know, you can go with mum and dad once, and you can come and put the hat on again, and then another couple of relatives can come, because it'll do the local hotels really good. I used to work at Sheffield. The overseas earnings at Sheffield Hallam and Sheffield Uni were $250 million a year, bigger than the metal work industry of South Yorkshire. And you might think the metal work industry of South Yorkshire is dead. It isn't. We have nice euphemism. It's an arms industry. Right? Where do you think the titanium shells are made and the manacles and all the other? It's places like South Yorkshire, just up from Derby. But the universities make more money than the arms trade. The other two are gambling. We're now the centre for world gambling. We have the largest gambling market in the world, bigger than the USA. Gordon Brown brought the taxes down to nearly zero. You might say that's great. Somebody's going to be running the world gambling industry, but it's kind of like not something to be proud of. And the third is banking. And by leaving the EU, we left the regulations so we can have our casino banks. Although, again, very clever washing. Somebody came up to Edinburgh and called them the Edinburgh Accords to make it sound as if it was somehow Miss Jean Brodie-like. But it was essentially allowing things to go on, which you wouldn't allow in a normal Western country. Done education, done health, housing. What a mess, really. It was after 25 years at working in housing that I finally met a senior civil servant who told me in Whitehall that our real aim is that London has the highest house prices in Europe, because then we know we've succeeded. I felt so stupid. I felt so stupid. Yeah, but you wonder why are house prices so high? Because we've had governments who've actually tried to push them up, help to buy, and things like that. Terrible homelessness rates. The second highest country in Europe for homelessness rates is Germany, after Merkel allowed in 1.5 million Syrians, and even then they had fewer people sleeping in tents under flyovers than we do. And it's staggering, but we've become used to it. It's amazing how quickly you can adapt to this and begin to see it as normal. We are essentially an Eastern European country. The bottom fifth of people in the UK have a lower standard of living than the bottom fifth in the average Eastern European country now. That's not me. That's Stephanie Flanders from Bloomberg Economics saying it. John Byrne Murdoch from the FT telling you this. But we're British. And we win lots of medals in the Olympics. And we've got a royal family still. And if we just try a bit harder and we just aim for the sunlit uplands and we increase our productivity somehow and all, you know, buckle up and stop those small boats arising in the south, all will be okay. And part of the shattering is your political parties falling apart. Labour lost its soul. In a way, Labour somehow lost its soul in the late 90s. Shifted, thinking it was being ever so clever, across to the right. Didn't realise that one consequence of that would be to push the Tories way over. So that in 2014, they left the European Conservative Group, EPP, and joined an alliance with Alternative for Deutschland, essentially with fascists. When we left the EU, the European Parliament lost its biggest block of far-right MEPs that it had ever had. That's UKIP and the Conservatives. These are MEPs aligned with groups, formally aligned. You have to be in a group in the Parliament. Formally aligned with complete and utter unmentionables in other countries. The far-right were left with Poland. You know, the Polish MEPs were the largest block. The Tufton Street, the far-right think tanks, had to use Warsaw, where they've got an Adam Smith Institute, but it's not very big. I mean, this is great news for EU. And, you know, a country was probably going to leave. A country had to leave. It's democratic, the EU. You don't have to be in. We've proved that. We've also helped point out what happens if you do leave. So none of the far-right parties in the EU now want to leave, right? And also, Poland's had an amazing election and done something different. There are lots of good news stories out there. Just not that many here. Although the bad news for you is that the best in the UK are here. Wales is trying to see if it can copy some of them. Northern Ireland doesn't do too badly because it sells affordable housing and because Theresa May gave him a £1 billion bung to try and hold her government together, which isn't great. How do we get out of this? What happens in my final 2 minutes? Because I'm keeping to time. It's the realization that this is the reality. Okay? There isn't going to be a sun on the meadows in the future, sunlit uplands. I got a shock. How many know where the lyric "The Sun on the Meadows" comes from? Right. I won't try and sing it. No. The song "Tomorrow Belongs to Me" from Cabaret, Hitler Youth. The sun on the meadows, the sunlit uplands. Yeah, right. The sunlit uplands appeared first of all in George Osborne's policy of 2015. This is where I'll end. Which was, if you follow my economic plan, and George completely believed this, then by the year 2030, we will have the highest GDP per capita in the world of any large country. George believed it. not only did George believe it, but his Secretary of State believed it. It was a young man called Matt Hancock, who Matt had to go out and defend it. In Boris Johnson's resignation speech, he said, "Hold firm, keep with the plan." And it was a slightly different, "We will have the highest growth of the G7 if you stick with my party." Keir Starmer's summer speech, again, slightly altered. Each time the sun on the meadows and the sunlit uplands watered down slightly. But just become more productive. Do more of this. Work harder. Don't ask for more. Don't complain that the Governor of Bank of England has paid that much. Make sure that those who are shirking are dealt with harshly. Take away, still in England, the child benefit from the third or fourth child. That's now Labour policy. Be tougher, be meaner, be nastier, and we'll somehow rise. There comes a point when it doesn't wash anymore. There comes a point when you're telling people in the south of England with the highest rents they've ever paid, rising higher than they've ever raised again, who are looking at paying rent into their 50s, who have no pensions, who have precarious jobs, and you keep trying to sell them the same lie, and it just isn't working. Now, there are other things going on in the world which are not in the book, so I won't mention them, but they're big. There's climate, of course, which is large. And you can look at the kind of dwindling commitment of the parties on that. But there's a war, two wars. And I partly think, if you look at young people around where I know, and I know universities and students, what we're currently seeing in the South and in London and in my own university is very similar to what we saw in the 1960s with Vietnam, where people of my age, if you imagine a 50-year-old in the 60s, were going, "What's going on? This isn't terribly important. Why are they protesting?" And they're going, "There's something very, very wrong with you lot," right? And this is yet another level. You know, we're burning the planet. We don't care about their future. And then we're supporting atrocities overseas. And it's beginning to alter things. But the what's on offer, at least in England, which is what matters in terms of controlling Westminster, as yet isn't great. But the situation is getting worse every month, because the cost of living crisis is now the longest since the one that began in 1798, which lasted 24 years. Right? We've beaten every other cost of living crisis. Inflation will come down, but still be high. So it's still going to cost you more to heat next year than the year before. And we still haven't insulated the home, so they actually get worse. So they lose more heat. I don't know where it's going to go, but I'm absolutely sure that what the Conservatives and what Labour are offering doesn't work. However, to end on a high point, something remarkable has happened. Another remarkable thing, not in Scotland. Every single pay deal in the last 16 months that I can get hold of, which is all the public sector ones, but also private sector ones like BT, the Commercial Workers Union, they're all progressive for the first time again since around the 1930s, 40s. And what I mean is, in 2019, the Commercial Workers Union, everybody got 3%. Inflation was 2%, you all get 3%. Sounds okay? It's not okay, because you're a 60-year-old man who's a senior telephone engineer. 3% is a lot more than the 3% of a woman on a low-paid job. But the unions were fairly conservative. They go for a flat percentage. The Communications Workers Union deal to stop them going on strike this year is the most amazing tiered deal, so that the lowest paid workers are not going to starve. They have the biggest increase, and people at the top don't have one. In the newspapers, in the Murdoch newspapers, you're only getting a pay increase on your salary below a certain level. Above that, nothing. Right? Concertinary. Health service. If you look at what the porters and the cleaners are getting and the nurses compared to the doctors. Civil servants. Junior civil servants have had a 12% pay cut since 2008 in real terms. Senior civil servants, 25%. Now, that may feel terrible if you're a civil servant, But if you think being the most unequal country in Europe is a problem, you need those two groups to come together. Every pay deal. MPs have taken something like 2.9, their lowest ever. And that's not in real terms, that's 2.9. So they've been taking a pay cut of about 7%. But of course, 2.9 of an MP's salary is quite good. Lastly, a prediction for you. Inflation's falling. MP salaries aren't bad. Most of them couldn't get a job that would pay them as much as an MP. I don't think the election's going to be until the autumn of next year, if not January 2025. Why would the Tories do it now? Why would they give up the gravy chain jobs they've got when they can be so sure, many of them, that they're going to lose those jobs? So I think we're still quite a long way from a general election. Thank you for letting me talk at you. You have experienced what an Oxford University lecture is like, because nobody asks a single question or butts in at all. They all sit there terrified, taking notes, because bless them, they all think they shouldn't be there and they're not good enough, which is better than them all thinking that they're superior than that. Thank you very, very much. And let's do short questions first and I'll do short answers. Go on.
I'll try and do a short one because you're totally depressing me now. Anecdotally, I feel that if you just look at social media, certainly over the last couple of years, it doesn't feel like people are wanting to vote Tory again, just the minority of them.
Yeah.
But given how bad the situation is in the political parties because of the two-party system, what are we going to do? You know, if you don't want Tory and the next biggest party is Labour, what do we do?
Yeah, what do you do of your choice?
If you want to get it changed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing is just realising how weird this is, because the mainland of Europe had PR for a century. It's undemocratic. The only other two countries that spend less on the public services in Europe were Spain and Greece, but only after Franco and after the generals. So only undemocratic countries, I should say states. I always try and use country and state differently. It's tricky in the UK. We have bishops in our House of Lords. It's weird. The vote for Brexit was partly you gave people a vote that for the first time in their life mattered. And if you hated the way things were going and you're worried about your grandchildren, what do you do? Do you vote the way you're supposed to vote or do you vote leave? And this wasn't just racism. I would say be aware that you're more free to vote in any way you wish now than you may ever have been. If you're tribal, my family, very tribal. There was only one party for us for years and years and years. Might still be the same party. But every other elected politician in my city, as of last week, this is dispersal, all voted for ceasefire. All Labour, both sides. We lost, by the way, you know, Oxford, we had 12 councillors resign now. All the Liberals, all the Greens, also West MP. The only elected politician in my city who hasn't is Annalise Dodds, who's my MP. Oh, I'd like her to vote the right way. And then she can have my vote. But if she doesn't, and I've only ever voted for one party in my life, right, suddenly I'm free. So you imagine you're free. Liberals are going to pick up a hell of a lot of seats in England. They're second already. They're keeping very quiet. They're going to pick up seats. Labour may well not pick up as many as they think they're going to get. Uxbridge, we all paint that as being about low traffic neighbourhoods. The young didn't bother coming out. The young don't care about low traffic neighbourhoods. They haven't got cars or driving licences. They were just not inspired. The old in Selby can be convinced to vote Labour. So that happened there. But in cities, young people, and cities with many mosques, Labour have lost it at the moment. Green Party could get themselves beyond one MP for the first time, which at the European level, it's amazing we have the smallest Green Party in Europe. The other thing is supporting politicians who are trying to do the right thing, and they're still there. They can't often say they are. my most ridiculous fantasy is that Sunak would actually like to win and be like Disraeli, and then thinks, what do I have to do to win? Now, part of it is to be nastier immigration policy, nastier on the environment. But the other would be to jump over Rachel Reeves and Keir and say, introduce a small sovereign wealth tax like Spain have. Get Hunt to do that in his statement as Chancellor in the last 1 minute of the budget speech. And then Sunak rises and says, we don't believe in taxation, but don't worry. I'm the only member of this House who has to pay this because none of you have enough wealth. But pays. Now, all kinds of things are possible when you're in a crisis like this. But it is awful. That's why we've gone through so many prime ministers. That's why if we need to borrow money as the UK, we have to pay 5.5% on 30-year borrowing. The international banks don't trust us. They think we may go insolvent as a country. If the government wants to bung £75 million to BMW in Oxford not to leave, on the same day it has to cut 250 from government spending so that the interest rate doesn't go up on our borrowing. Right, we're that near the line. But that does mean, you know, that things become possible. But we're going to be poor. We are poor and we're going to be poor. The question is, can we be poor in a better way? And can we get out of being poor slowly and sensibly, rather than thinking somehow we're going to hit another jackpot, new North Sea oil, another kind of banking? You know, we've sold almost every kind of thing we can sell, other than Parliament itself, which I'd sell. It's a liability, it's falling down. But no, I can't give you optimism because it's that bad. I can argue with almost any other country in Europe's in a better situation. We do one at the back.
Two half questions. Take the one you think is more interesting.
Okay.
One is, you know, you said 74 was the most equal we've ever been. That was what 45 years, almost 50 years now.
Yeah.
How long would it take to reverse the direction? Or the Tom Nairn argument, the UK is in the position it is because it never had a revolution. Would it take independence or some other revolutionary thing to get that reversal? And yeah, take that as you wish.
They're the same question, I reckon. it's almost always takes two or three generations to go from your most unequal height to the best position over many different countries. My favourite is Finland, usually divided 100 years ago. Really took a long time for Finland to get where it is. Revolutions tend to increase inequality, but we haven't had one for a long time. The fastest way to become more equal is to lose a war. You don't necessarily want to fight one, let alone lose one. The ideal thing is that the Americans invade, bomb a city, are petrified that there's going to be a revolution, take the land off the aristocracy, distribute it equally, and create the world's most equal country, which is Japan. Right? Right? The Japanese economic miracle wasn't, you know, it was incredible change. But Germany, Finland, was on the wrong side of a war. Whenever you lose a war, your elite are replaced by a very different bunch. They're always better. Being invaded has a similar effect, but not as the tanks rolling over. But France, again, your elite are altered a bit. Not as much, but they normally collaborated, or at least they've certainly failed. So in a way, we're unlucky in that only Channel Island was invaded. But when the young men did come back, it's interesting what people told people here and then what they felt out there. When they came back after the Second World War, we could have avoided. They did for 30 years behave in a different way and not trust the old again. But it'll take time. I've made myself very unpopular for saying, if you get independence, you'll be the most unequal Nordic country by a mile. And you can't get out of your blood and bones now certain feelings that just simply come from having grown up It's not. It's like being a really heavy smoker. You know, it's there. I'm afraid you've had it. Look around us. Look at this part of Edinburgh. Look at the schools. You know, it's not that different. But it's about the children and the grandchildren. And we're very rich still, even after all of this, not being able to borrow. So you can make a utopian case for getting a bit poorer every year, which is likely, but very rapidly more equal. We have more education buildings per head than anywhere else in Europe. It's just we don't use them well. 7% are, 7% of the children are private. That's about 30% of the, you know. Those school rules falling down is not a problem. We've got school buildings. You just need to move them around. We've got more empty bedrooms per person we've ever had. We've got the housing stock. You don't need to build a single one. There's a huge amount you can do, but it isn't about being top again. While you're still thinking that we've got to be number one, that's hard. And all countries that have been at the centre of the largest empire in the world have all taken at least over 100 years to get over it.
Hi, Johnny. I used to work in housing research, like you, and long been interested in the gap between policy aspirations and the actual implementation. And I think earlier this year I attended a Health Foundation seminar on inequality in Scotland, and it was fascinating because we actually talked about inequality in Scotland and how the policies that we wanted, that we imagine in Scotland, I live here now.
Yeah.
We imagine that the policies we have are fabulous, and that the problem is that we don't get implemented.
Yeah.
So people in my world have started to talk about the implementation. On the grapevine, I hear that seminar really pissed people off in the Scottish government, because they don't like the idea that their policies might not be wonderful or that they might not be being implemented.
Mm.
And at the same seminar, somebody said, so there's one policy that there is no implementation. That's austerity.
Mm.
That's working. That's intentional.
Yes.
So what policies do you know where there is no implementation gap?
On them. I'd say there is an implementation gap in austerity. What George wanted, Baroness Farsi, who I love Baroness Farsi, because she's outspoken and so on, but I once saw her lecture a very large number of school children. And they asked her why she was a conservative, and she said, because our taxes are too high, because in the Quran, it actually says you should tax, I think, I'll get this wrong, but I think she said 2%. But that was trying to bring taxes in from zero, right? Not to get them down. So quite a lot of the architects of austerity wanted it to be twice as big as it has been. There was kickback. We do not have children in the gutters. There's a whole, yeah, some things haven't gone. But the privatisation of universities, other than that they've still got the cap at 9,250, there's a lot of talk about that cap going, bang, suddenly. £60,000 to come to my university. Somebody will pay it. So that's still there. Arms and defence. You might say that they would like to spend more, but I think we're spending more than anywhere else in Europe. So there's an obvious cost saving, unless you think those rusted old submarines are actually protecting anybody that we pay the Americans to maintain. We don't even know work, which is quite good. The cruelty over benefits, I think, is working. Lowest benefits for single adults in Europe. Most effective sanction regime. The fines in 1 year were higher than all the fines for all crimes committed in sheriff's courts and magistrates' courts in England. And these were the sanctions for not doing everything correct to get your miserly amount of benefit money. David Freud. David Freud was a minister under Labour who carried on being minister when the Conservatives came in 2010. Right? So that's one. If your minister or advisor remains the same person, then it can be really effective. And the same with universities south of the border. Peter Mandelson literally handed the baton to David Willetts, and the policy remained the same. So where Labour and the Tories have agreed with each other, that's when it's been, if you like, the most vicious kind of cuts. And I want an altruistic thing where your parties agree with each other, they do good things. It does all swing at once. So 100 years ago, we were incredibly unequal. We were in political disarray. Labour was a new party, went all over the place. The 30s were awful. But all your parties began to move to the left. It was a Tory health minister who was partly responsible for the NHS. We'd like to pretend it wasn't, but they were there. Beveridge was a misogynistic eugenicist liberal for his report in 1942. The Conservatives built more council houses than Labour in the 1950s. They're all moving to the left together, and then they all move to the right together. So that Merkel is far to the left of Jeremy Corbyn in terms of policies, a conservative in Germany. Corbyn never said he'd let 1.5 million Syrians in. You might think he might have done. He had proposals in the manifestos of 2017 and 2019, which didn't quite get us the German levels of redistribution under Merkel. Okay.
That's you. We're saying the book festival in 2014, when you were talking about the housing crisis, and then the next year you came back and you were talking about the inequality crisis. Mm. You know, well, your talk has been just as depressing as I thought. I'm a follower of inequality, you know.
Yeah.
Of your books. But surely, I mean, Labour and Murdoch, by the way, the pals and walls you have meeting. Surely we must have a wealth tax. It's the only way for anything to do. We can get somewhere. You know, the first New Labour, they had that much money. They had two wars. Mm. And then, of course, Brown's financial thing cost us many billions. It's unbelievable. You know, so it has to be a wealth tax or nothing.
No, I agree. We need a wealth tax now, simply because we can't borrow. You know, 5.5% over 30 years is simply too high. And we need a wealth tax. We're going to have to bail Thames Water out when they go bust in a few months' time. You know, just to get the sewage taken away from my house. That's my water company. And because I want drinking water. You know, so we need one. I quite like wealth taxes anyway because I'm a lefty. However, the interesting thing is that those Nordic countries, and interestingly, there are five countries in the mainland of Europe that are now more equal than the five, more equitable than the five Nordic countries, which are Iceland, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Finland, and five which are almost as equal, will whisker, including Germany and France. So essentially, we've got 15 Nordic countries. But in those classic Nordic countries, wealth inequalities are quite high, but they do really well because income inequalities are low. And the wealthy are really controlled, which means they might own a big estate, but they have to let people walk across it, but they still own it. They can't own the newspapers. Where the deal gets a bit dirty, I think, is with house prices. When you look at the middle of Helsinki and Stockholm and Oslo, and the quiet deal between the right and the left is, we'll let your houses be incredibly expensive in the middle of our capital cities as long as nobody is homeless. And we have decent council housing with saunas in each one in Finland. So there's an accommodation. There's a really interesting political accommodation in what are currently the most income equitable countries, which is we're going to tax you really highly. You're all going to go to school together. We won't have such things, but we'll let you hold on to a little bit of your wealth as long as you don't try and stop this. Now, personally, I don't think wealth makes people very happy. But it's easy for me to say that. I think most people think it would. But no, a wealth tax. And imagine if the Tories brought one in. And of course, Sunak's one skill, the only thing he actually knows, the thing he's been trained at since he was 22, is wealth tax avoidance. That's in a sense what he's worked in. You know, they're incredibly well equipped to bring a wealth tax in. properly, in a fair way. And you do it in the same way that income tax was first introduced. It's a temporary emergency. But how would I vote? This is a game I've been playing with myself. If the Tories said that they're going to go for a wealth tax and Labour wouldn't, how do I vote? You know, I and it feels very, very dirty. But I would find it hard, would find it very hard not to go, let's just give them a tick, let's just encourage it.
Yes. Like Boris Johnson, and just totally ignore what that vote was. The Tories are the Tories through.
Totally ignore the promise of the 350 million on the side of the bus. Except that the promise in the manifesto would have fed into the international interest rates. So we're not the only audience. If you're telling the people who are gambling money worldwide, this is what you're going to do, and they look at Britain and say, oh, fine, they're going to bring in a little wealth tax, which other countries have, they're taking this seriously, then you might say, okay, we'll lend you at 5% rather than 5.5. But you don't do it when you win. Well, you're completely untrustworthy then, aren't you? 6-7% interest. So they don't have the leeway. We're not an independent sovereign country. We can't just print money. If we print money, the food's not going to arrive. We won't be able to borrow, and we have to borrow because we're in such a bad state. But I'm being... You can't predict the future. It's just what you can do is say that in the past, well, and always, the place which is worse almost always doesn't end up being worse in 5 years' time. Just by chance and randomness. It takes a lot of effort to keep on making things as bad as this. You know, it's really hard. I said, Thatcher, 30% of the population benefited. Right? It's now really not all of the 1% are financially benefiting. Some older people who've got savings look like they're getting better off, but they've got families. So we're down to benefiting about 3/4 of the 1%. And it's quite hard to get the population to carry on behaving like you want them to behave while they're watching their living standards fall and seeing their grandchildren. And then what you do is you tell them, oh, the problem for your grandchildren is it's all the immigrants taking their jobs, their school places, their houses. You know, if we only stop immigration, it'll all be fine for the grandchildren. And you can divert people for a few decades on hating immigrants, but it doesn't carry on working.
What do you think of the universal basic income?
I think it's the equivalent of suggesting unemployment benefit around 1888. So 1888 was when we first had unemployment being recognised as an issue, and the first people to suggest unemployment benefit were laughed out of court, of this wouldn't work. Loads of experiments. The latest one I saw is Kenya, which was fairly successful. Some people really don't like it. Wales has got a big one going on at the moment. Finland's done a number. You bring it in at a low level. You don't have to bring it in at a level you can live off. The EU could do this. If you imagine, I don't know, 3,000 euros a year across for every adult in the EU, that means a lot on the periphery of Europe, which is an encouragement to stay on that small island in the Aegean, which is really nice. But it's green because essentially it tells you if you want to work less, you can, but you're going to be worse off because it will never give you what work will give you, but you're not going to starve. So if we want to reduce consumption, it makes sense. So there are lots of reasons for it, but it'll have to come in at a low level. And it'll never cover the needs of anybody with additional needs. If you're disabled, it doesn't cover. But I think it makes as much sense as unemployment benefit makes sense, and unemployment benefit makes sense. Now, we just don't need everybody working. We haven't needed everybody working for quite a long time. You know, when I was young, my dad took me to the car factory where 40,000 men worked to scare me into working hard at school. Now that car factory, the one we've bunged BMW 75 million to keep, has 1,200 beautiful robots. They're all of a particular size. It's the exact size that you can fit in the back of an articulated lorry, so you can move the factory. And they're silent, and they're making electric minis. And you can say, oh, we can get everybody to do another job. But you need people to do less, you're making less. So I'm very, very for it. But it's how it comes in, who does it first, how you, and we have it also. You know, pension credit guarantee for pensioners. Child benefit for everybody was one, and then we took it away from people who have a certain salary. So there are various basic incomes already, but I'm favourable. Sorry. Yeah.
Let's just be our final question.
Okay.
I was going to ask that, and so that's good to hear from you on that. And it's great having the book at this point. Do you think that there's good podcasts happening to keep in touch with this going forward?
Oh, yeah, that's great. Last question. So I've written an article on one of the podcasts. I was commissioned by the Conversation to do it on the one that Ed Balls and George Osborne does. And he asked me to write an article before it started. And I said, no, so I'm going to make myself listen to the first three episodes. So you can Google that, just, you know, Danny Dorning podcast Conversation and see. So that one's terrible, except that you have the two of them telling each other how wonderful they are. And then it's the same company. It's Gary Lineker's company that does this. You've got Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrook, I think. And then what's the third one? Alistair Campbell and Rory. Okay, it's all men. All tend to be fairly right-wing, warmongering men, all agreeing with each other, generally private school. Surviving Society. Google Surviving Society, the podcast. It's three young people in London. It's much more realistic. It's quite funny. But there are loads and loads. None of them, of course, are as big as those three commercial ones. But there are lots. They tend to be aimed at a market of people in their 30s and 20s. They tend to fit jogging or other activities I don't do. But they're there and there's a plethora. Or you can listen to some in the States and they're wonderful and different. I was going to pitch one, which is called The Rest is Geography, which will be everything, the planet, green, whatever. But my pitch to Gary Lineker was it wouldn't be me. They'd be young for a start. They'd both be women and much more. And they'd be talking about the environment, but everything else on the planet. And the whole point was that they'd be completely different from the big three podcasts of smug, self-serving men who were all in power during this period where we really mucked everything up. And they think we're going to listen to them. So there are lots, but Surviving Society, my last plug, just Google Surviving Society podcast, because that's my favourite one. Thank you. Thank you very much.